With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In the My Seven Wonders podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. And the guest who joined me for this recording is an Irish comedian who performs regularly at the Edinburgh Festival and at festivals and tours all around the world, as well as on any number of TV shows. And he presents his own series on Radio 4. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Andrew Maxwell.
Oh, yes. Good reaction. Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon.
A proper comedian coming on with a pint of beer.
Why not? I thought I'll have a pint with Clive.
Look,
again.
I'm a bit droopy here. I can't.
Last night.
Good to see you. Good to see you.
Very nice to see you, Clive. Yeah. Now tell them why I'm here.
You're here to do my seven.
No,
wonders.
Because you cornered me in a bar at 3 a.m. and made me do it. I tell you, he's quite a forceful man. It's not all affability with this fucker.
Oh, no. Tell me what just to get on your side. What's the name of your show and where is it?
It's called Krakatoa.
Yes.
I've got an interactive volcano this year, Clive.
Yes. I'm laughing. I don't know.
There's a projection of a volcano.
Yeah.
Other than this, this is a stand-up hour, but there's a projection of a volcano.
Excellent.
And anybody in the room shouts Krakatoa.
Yeah.
It sets the volcano off. There's an explosion. There's some smoke and some lighting effects.
Isn't that a bit dangerous? You're in the middle of a quiet bit of, build up to a joke and somebody shouts Krakatoa.
That's right.
Ruined.
That's right.
Ruined.
Danger.
Yeah.
Danger, yeah. Clive.
Yeah.
Because that's the visual metaphor of the volcano.
Oh, no, I follow. Yes.
It can destroy the world, but it also can make the most fertile soils.
Excellent. Well, we haven't got anything like that here, but do bear in mind this is being recorded for a podcast. So if there is a quiet bit in our conversation, you can throw in a sort of sort of laugh like that. Yeah. It'll be confusing, but it means you can pick yourself on the recording if you happen to go and listen.
You'll hear
to
yourself
it.
At it.
Yes.
Last night there was so much Krakatoas, I got completely lost inside the smoke.
Oh no. So,
yeah, sometimes people have the devil in them.
Yes.
And once they realise they have the power.
Yeah.
They just won't stop shouting Krakatoa. Yeah. I lost a good 10 minutes of the show to the volcano.
Now, I've introduced you as a comedian, obviously, and I know you from your stand-up act and your tours and everything.
Yes.
But I thought I'd better check to just check what you're known for. So I went to that authority on things, Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which, oddly enough, is not featured as a wonder of the world, which I think is a wonder
it
of
is.
The world, even though my entry is completely wrong. There's more mistakes in my entry than it's physically possible.
You think of the amount of tech billionaires and Jimmy Wales is still kicking around. And
he did it for free.
He did it for free. Bono made a billion.
Yes.
He's one of the founding investors in Facebook. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
He knows what he's doing, isn't he?
What a podcast.
But he gives it all away, doesn't he?
I'm sure he does.
In tax, if necessary. Yeah.
he certainly supplies the pubs of Dublin, trust me.
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay, best known for narrating the MTV reality series X on the Beach.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like Love Island with knobs on, isn't it?
So it sure is.
Yes.
I think you've completely sold it.
Yeah.
That's right. It makes Love Island look like the opera.
Yeah. So how did you get involved in doing that?
Well, it was really strange. It was so you know yourself. So in television is bullshit. And 99% of everything in television is bullshit.
Don't you involve me in your
you know, don't
views.
Pretend. Yeah. Meetings and meetings.
Yes, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of handshaking and bullshit.
Yeah.
Basically, you've never done something on television until it's been broadcast and the money's in your bank account.
Right.
Up to that point, you've just been glad-handed half to death.
Yeah.
So, and basically what TV executives do is they have to fill their work diary with meetings.
Mm.
So they'll pull people in to have meetings with them in Soho. You'll have a great time.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll have a great time. But nothing comes of it.
Yeah.
And your agent calls you the next day and they go, how did it go? And you go, it was very positive. that's literally the television world. Yeah. So,
and the person you're having a meeting with is positive, but he's still got to, or she's got to go and sell it to somebody else.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Somebody else.
There's a lot of glad.
But this obviously got sold.
So what happened was, I got asked to go to this meeting to do a voiceover. I'd never done voiceovers.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, all right. Mm. It's quite unusual. So I go into Soho, meet these people. They'd made a show previously called The Valleys.
Mm.
The Valleys makes Geordie Shore look like the opera.
Yes, yeah.
It was the Welsh version of Geordie Shore.
Oh, right.
Yes, exactly. Yes. It was all that sort of stuff. Yeah. I think one guy stuck a battery up his bum for no reason, one episode.
Yeah.
It's that level of, you know what I mean?
Well, keep himself going. That's
You'd hope so, Clive. Yeah. But anyway. So
or in France, they said because he had piles. But that depends on you knowing what the... Yeah, yeah.
rotten. All that education and this where it ends.
Yeah.
So I go into the meeting, and it's just your standard TV meeting. And the end of it, they were like, well, what do you think? Do you want to do it?
Hmm.
And I'm like, well, yeah, I'd like to do it. And they're like, well... So we're going to do it?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And they go, well, should we shake hands and you're going to do it? I'm like, well, yeah, I'd like to do it.
Yeah.
Just years of just vagary. So we shook hands and went, right, you're doing it. And I was like, oh,
fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, said from no voiceover experience, I was like, why me?
Mm.
And they went, well, we were looking for somebody for the show. And we looked at a lot of comedians on YouTube. And we saw you and we thought, this guy is a bastard. I've never felt more seen.
Yes. Well, that's a fair point. That's a good reason for getting the job. And I think many people would at least
agree
entertain that idea. Well, and just while I'm just dealing with the oddities of your career, odd to me anyway, because you've also done I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
I have.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago.
I did the last series in the jungle.
Yeah.
I didn't do any damp cave or damp castle in Wales. I did 2019.
When I saw that you were in it, I mean, I heard you were in it, and also Ian Wright, a great Arsenal
well, obviously is your team.
Yes, and I thought, well, you've both got big personalities. You really get on well. It's going to be a... But you had a bit of a sort of clash, didn't you?
No, I knew... The thing is, I actually know Ian through Ian Stone, who, as you know, is a very funny comedian and also a massive gooner.
Yeah.
And so I knew Ian anyway. Mm. And for the first week, it's amazing, but you're starving.
Mm.
You are starving.
Yeah.
You know, you were very, very hungry. 600 calories a day. And most people are on 2,500.
Right.
So you're very, very hungry. This just give you an idea of how hungry you are on I'm a Celeb. 3 days in, everybody in the camp, we all started stuttering.
Right.
We all started...
Is that an effect of under-eating, is it?
It turns out it's the collapse in your blood sugar.
Mm.
It affects the serotonin, and serotonin's closely connected to stuttering and stammering. So we're all stuttering and stammering, and each one of us going into... The Bush Telegraph, you know, the diary room. That's how you'd interface with the production team. And all of us were like, I can't talk. And they were like, it's fine. It'll take 24 hours. It's all your blood sugar finally leaving your system. And then you'll start burning your fats and you'll be fine again. So that's how hungry we were.
This is like a slimming cure more than anything. But
you
had a bit of an argument about, well, because you didn't do the washing up or something.
I don't know. You it's so micro. You've got is bickering over washing.
But why did you do it? Why did you? Because I know several people have done it and I'm completely flummoxed. The reality things to do.
Yeah.
To go and sit and have to eat bugs and live with no food and all those challenges, which are just game show things, really, aren't they?
Oh, 100%.
But they're quite stressful things to do.
Yeah, but weirdly, once you're in the show, that you want to get picked to fight a snake.
Yeah.
Because it's something to do.
Yes.
But it basically, I've been gigging in Australia as long as I've been here at the Fringe, so 27 years.
Yeah.
And I've gigged all over in all the cities of Australia and whatnot. Yeah. Done a little bit of some sort of car journeys up and down coasts and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the opportunity of you know, living in the actual Aussie bush was just too, you know, it was awesome.
Okay.
Because you basically, you're safe as houses, right? You are genuinely in the bush. There's two killer animals amongst you. There's funnel web spiders and brown snakes.
Right.
Both of them, without the antidote, will kill you.
Yeah.
But they're, but you beyond the camera ranges. So sort of the distance of this room from what, say, if we are in the camp, we're the campmates, nattering away, behind the camera arrays are Aussie Special Forces, who are with you 24 hours a day.
Oh, right.
So there, you're completely protected. One day, I was so hungry.
You ate one of the Aussie Special
Forces. I did, yeah. Shoes and all. Yeah. I started dying. So what happened was, genuinely, I started dying, yeah.
You're taking a long time over it.
Yeah, yeah, it can take a while.
Yeah.
It was, we had camel. We had one camel meat.
All right, one hump or two.
I think it was from the loin,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Whatever. But it's basically, it's nice. It's sort of between beef and lamb. It's somewhere between beef and lamb.
Okay.
But we were so hungry, and it, you know, it is a sort of steak-esque consistency, if you make sense. And I ate some of it, and I just didn't chew it.
Mm.
I inhaled it.
Yeah.
And I started choking to death.
God.
On television, and I'm on my knees, yeah. I'm dying. I've got Kate Garraway slapping me on the back.
Yes.
Like very weak wifey slaps.
Yes.
Right, I'm dying.
What about Ian Wright? Ian Wright
wasn't there. He was elsewhere.
Yeah.
Eventually, it was a guy called Andy Whiteman, who's been in Corrie for almost 30 years.
Yes.
He really punched me in the back because he didn't like me, but he saved my life. So that's something. But I was choking to death. This is all on camera. It went out on the show.
Yeah.
Right? But the Aussie Special Forces were coming to do a tracheotomy to actually slit my throat.
Oh, you put a biro in or something?
Yeah, they were going to do. They were actually going to do me.
Oh, and they were thinking, fantastic.
Yeah, here's an opportunity.
The first time we've had something to do.
Yeah.
Nine series.
Got to slit somebody's throat on television. And it just, the meat fired out.
Right.
I caught it and I ate it straight away.
Oh, no.
You're so hungry. Oh. I'm not like... Oh. The meat didn't mean to kill me. It was my fault. But I caught it.
Dogs that do things like that.
But, I know.
Look, we better get on to your wonders. I just thought I'd check on this. So those probably make you more famous than years and years of performing comedy.
Everything's in silos of different sort of stuff. So it was like, I'm a celebrity, 17, 18 million people watch every episode.
Yeah.
But they're not the people that come to the Fringe.
Yeah.
And vice versa. It's the same with the you know, I do a lot on Radio 4. And do the MTV thing, but that's a Venn diagram that does not touch. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
you know,
like, yes, I should have.
Nobody knows that over here I'm talking about some dude that's pissed in a pot.
I should have mentioned you have series on Radio 4 because that's the ultimate accolade of the entertainment industry.
I think your own
series on Radio 4.
Well, I think so.
Yeah, so do I. Now, let's get on to you.
It's the senior section, isn't it?
It is, yes.
It does feel like you're in the light entertainment Royal Navy.
Yes, the Marines even. So let's start with your first...
They do what they're told.
Your first wonder is the Alps.
The Alps!
Yeah. Okay, so this... I think I know why you've put them on, but is it because of the scenery, the skiing, the fresh air, or what?
All the above, absolutely. So for years we've had our own comedy festival out there. Myself and Marcus Brigstock started it, called Altitude.
Yes.
First 3 years we were in the French Alps. And then it's impossible to do business with the French. So we.
I think that's why the Brexit went the way it did.
Yeah, no, genuinely, the cheap one day, this is genuinely true. This is just France, right? It's just, I love France. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like some sort of Daily Mail France basher. But like, we had a meeting with the chief of police and the mayor. We had lunch with them in the afternoon one day.
Yeah.
And then we did all our shows, did the festival, and then we had a late night bar show, right? Which would go from 11 till 1 in the morning, which we had a license for, everything. And I was emceeing it, and there was a really heavy bang on the door. The bar is rammed with just British and Irish and Aussie stoners and snowboarders, you know what I mean? And there was a boom, 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 boom on the door.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, woo! So I go open the door, and there's the chief of police and the other three cops in town in full riot gear.
Right.
And he's like literally the quintessential French chief of police. A little fat fucker.
Yeah.
Weird, sleazy moustache, massive belly, sweaty hair.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, in Pink Panther cartoon?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, that guy, right?
This is why we travel, is to meet people like this.
Yeah, exactly. So he's there, right? And I'm like, what's going on? Like, obviously, you know,
Yeah.
Greeted him by our first names. What with us having lunch that afternoon together. I spoke to him in English. He says back to me, I don't speak English in English. Yeah. And then sucker punched me.
Oh, wow.
He dropped me in front of the whole audience, right?
That is a really bad heckle, isn't it? Yeah. The chief of police comes on and punches you.
I goes, what the fuck's going on? Yeah. He goes, you're not. It's not legal for you to do the show now in the venue. And I went, and now, like, my blood's up, but they're all, I'm surrounded by cops and riot gear, right? And there's the audience there. They're like,
so well, they're getting their money's worth, really.
Yeah, yeah, what a show.
Never had a rant about this and that.
Yeah, bollocks all that. Let's see physical combat between two men out of shape. Yeah. So I went just being facetious, but I was kind of, my blood was boiling. Yeah. I went, can we do the gig outside then?
Yeah.
Expecting him to give me a second dig. But he went, yeah, I don't care about that.
Well, so what was the rule that meant that you couldn't do it?
We have no idea to this day. So they all get back in. So outside, there was a couple of bar tables.
Yeah.
Then there was a swimming pool. The whole thing is a whole hotel complex.
Yeah.
All of it owned by the most powerful man in the town, who is his business partner.
Yeah.
Right? We, 180 shit-faced British and Irish kids and Aussies, then poured out of the bar at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
and carried on the gig outside while smashing glasses and singing songs for another 3 hours. Well, right beside us, they methodically just took off their riot gear and fucked off.
Yeah. And that, so there was something about the venue.
No idea. Yeah. We have no idea.
But he hit you.
Oh, he sucker punched me with the short end of the baton.
I would like to suggest you might have a case against him in law, but I can't give you that advice because I'm on strike along with all the other English barristers at the moment.
And also, what do you know about Code Napoleon? Investigating judges, it must frighten you.
Yes, it's a complicated system. Basically, you're guilty once the investigating judge has decided you did it.
Yeah.
That's how the system works.
I mean, in all fairness, it's probably true.
Well, it doesn't sound as though you were guilty of anything much there. Other than breaking some rule that
we don't know,
you should have discussed over lunch if he was going to.
Well, it was a perfectly pleasant lunch. Yeah. Like I picked up the tab. But we both had steak tartare.
But now you do it. Now you do the your.
We've been in the Austrian Alps for years.
And Austrians are much more nicer people.
Oh, totally different.
Long history from going right back to the Sound of Music.
Which, by the way, is never shown there,
isn't it?
It's the only country in the world where they don't show Sound of Music.
And why is that? Because that we mispronounce Edelweiss in the song and it...
They don't like it.
They don't like it?
They don't like it. It's a very different country. It's basically Vienna is super left-wing and then the rest of the country is super right-wing. It's sort of almost like Austin and the rest of Texas.
Okay.
That's sort of what Austria is.
So you're saying they're sympathetic to the Nazis in the film and there's a sad ending. Is that what you're suggesting?
I am. I can show you the voting record of the region.
But they're just all war films from that point of view are always going to be a disappointment if you take that view.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, yes, they're going to have an anti-climax. Yes.
All right, so you do that. And
but the reason why...
Did you invent this festival for you and Marcus Brigstock to be able to put your skiing... journeys against tax or
yes
or, yes
yeah absolutely yeah. I mean quite yes
yes
okay. yes
again
I mean yes I mean it's
again,
either that
I
or a weekend
you
in Birmingham
to say no in answer to that question. So it's been a success. I know you've been doing it for several years.
Oh, 15 years. Yeah.
Does that mean your skiing is now super good?
Oh, I snowboarded beforehand.
You snowboarded beforehand.
So basically when I moved to England to work on a circuit in the early 90s when I was 20, all my mates from Dublin moved to Munich.
Yeah.
The Irish kids of every generation just go, this is our city.
Right.
And we're going to rule the roost here for 10 years.
Okay.
So, like, the Irish kids have done...
Boston.
Boston, absolutely. But more, they love San Diego.
Yeah.
They love Sydney. They love Toronto.
All right.
And they love Munich. And they'll just move in a clump of 20,000 of them.
Really?
And create their own economic and social ecosystem.
This is like the Vikings going around the world, isn't it? Yeah.
Seriously, PB, one of the best beaches in the whole of Southern California,
just
got conquered by Irish kids for five years.
Okay.
That's how we sort of... My mates were drinking themselves to death because it's the finest beer in the world.
Yeah.
What with them having the Rheinheitsgebot. Which is, since the 14th century, you can only have four ingredients in German beer, so you never have a hangover.
Yeah.
There's no shit in their beer.
Never have a hangover.
You never have a hangover.
Not even with one of those. You'll never have alcohol because
you'll never have a hangover.
No, okay.
There's nothing else in it. There's only four things.
Yes.
And all you have to do is rehydrate yourself with water, and you're up and right. running. So they were drinking themselves.
I always love listening to you because you've got such good advice and so reliable. I just know it's all true.
I mean, a citation needed. Yeah. At all times. Yeah. But so that's the reason why.
All right. So that's the Alps.
That's why I discovered the Alps.
I've got to move on to Please. Your next wonder, that which is swimming. Is your next?
Yes.
So this is. River deep, mountain high, we're getting through.
That's right.
So swimming, is you watch it, you do it.
Well,
you
I did do it like everybody else. Do it? I did all the school swimming, right?
Yeah.
And then I lived for 20 years in North London, like you. And I discovered the ponds in Hampstead.
Oh, right. So this is outdoor swimming.
That's right. And yeah. I just became very passionate about that. Made some great friends, one of my best mates who's since passed away, but just a great life.
Yeah.
Just the ponds, the lifeguards are all second generation Irish dudes from North London. They get paid really well by the City of London to read newspapers and listen to Five Live all day.
Yeah.
They're some of the most sophisticated men I've ever met.
Well, let's just explain. Hampstead Heath in London is
the biggest part of
big, and it's got these more or less natural ponds.
Three artisanal wells.
And for one reason or other, the City of London, the financial district,
owns it
and runs it. And they are often saying, as I've understood it, "Ooh, can we stop having people swimming these ponds? Because it's a little bit dodgy with the infections you might better put." And anytime they say that, people like you go, "Yeah," and we want to carry on.
No, it's always clean. It's basically it's
spring
like a lot.
Water.
It's spring water. It's chalk hills. Yes. So the water is brackish by its nature, but it's very clean. Like there's a lot of life in there. There's crayfish. There's all sorts.
Yes. Oh, there's a problem with crayfish, isn't there? There's some invasive species that come out of the water.
Delicious invasive species. And really easy to catch.
Yeah, you just have to get a bucket and take them away.
Yeah.
But sometimes, I don't swim there, but I have walked my dogs, various dogs there over the years, and sometimes there's signs up saying, "Don't let your dog go into this water. It's dangerous."
It's got
an infection.
The bloom, the algal bloom. Yeah.
So I just wonder, and you see this, so is it still there? There's a men-only pool. And there's women-only pool.
And they're open all year round, and then the mixed is only open during the summer.
So do you go over the mixed, the men?
Men's in the winter, and then obviously mixed in the summer.
Yes.
But it's an amazing group of people. Like, you get extraordinary cross-sections. Mm. Had a couple of runs-ins with the Russian intelligence there over the years because their spy base is beside the men's pond.
Right.
It's right there.
So how does that crop up when you're swimming along?
Oh, you'll know. Yeah. You'll know them. Yeah. They're thugs. They're pieces of shit.
Yes.
I had to throw one of them out one time.
Yeah.
There's a men's pond.
Do you get a lot of arguments with people?
It seems like I'm way more aggressive than I am, but I'm not. But I have had run-ins with Russian intelligence there. Yes.
Do you worry about that? You might suddenly find somebody with a big hand pushing your head under
these
the water.
These are deeply incompetent, thuggish people. They're useless.
Well, they do manage to bump off a few biscuits. Yeah, only unaccountable deaths of enemies of Putin.
Yeah, but they're only people they've already met before. Yeah. I
wouldn't go on any high balconies with any of these guys.
No. I stay at water level with them.
Yes.
And then it's a 50-50. Yeah.
And you prefer swimming in ponds than to go to a swimming pool or swim in the sea as well?
Lakes, rivers, sea. Yeah. I live in Kent now, I swim there. Yeah. Probably one of the most amazing things about swimming outside is swimming in the rain.
Yes.
Because obviously your eyes are at the actual water level.
Mm.
But when rain hits a surface of water,
the
raindrops then bounce back up sort of, 3 or 4 inches.
Yeah.
And each raindrop forms this beautiful silver sphere just only for a very, very split second.
Right.
But it's just an amazing thing to be in. And when you swim outside and it rains, I'm sure there's obviously an obvious reason for it. Mm. Like there's some sort of physiological reason.
Yeah.
But the sea gets warmer.
All right.
Instantly.
Yeah.
It's so much warmer when it rains on you. And it's just a beautiful freeing moment. Right. The reason why I gig in Sydney is to swim.
Yeah.
I go down there for a swim. Yeah. Basically a swimming holiday where I gig. Yeah. I'm very obsessed with swimming. So
Are you okay with the seawater when there's the odd bucket of sewage comes flying past you?
Yeah, you start to see it. You can see it. It moves differently, in the water. I mean,
there's bits and pieces in the water.
It just moves. The consistency of the water is heavier than the better water around it, and you can see where to swim past it.
All right.
But in Sydney, there's 120 beaches, and I swim there, and you know, you can, if you swim over 2 hours in the sea, and this sounds going to sound hippie, and I know you won't agree with me, and I'm not a hippie either, but you can sense the sharks.
Okay.
It, once you've been in for a long period of time.
Yeah.
It's something around the back of your ears.
Isn't that the music?
Yes, they have an opera with it. They've got a chamber orchestra with them at all times.
And so you obviously get maybe even a spiritual thing out of it, but it's also physically good for you, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, the other thing is, you know, I've got a lot of mates who are still in the world of contact sport.
Yeah.
You know, football or whatever. I'm 48. I don't want anything. Like, with swimming, everything's pulling at the same mass and ratio at the same time, you know? Yeah. But I do it more for the head, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's just it's a very good head clear.
Well, that's a very good wonder. And a lot of people say swimming's really good for you. Maybe even takes us back to our origins before we crawled out of the water.
Maybe. Yeah. I basically tried to find where I could get eaten by a shark.
Okay.
So, if you go about Sydney, there's the harbour, and there's bull sharks there. They're the length of a couch, very aggressive.
Yes.
And then there's obviously in the ocean side, Manly and Bondi, most famously, you'll have great whites. But they now don't really come in. It's too brackish, whatnot. Temperature's not right for them. Yeah. So, there's over like 80 beaches within the harbour.
Yeah.
And it turns out there's one beach is the most likely to get eaten by a shark.
Yes.
And that's Clontarf Beach.
Okay.
Which is named after a suburb of Dublin. Right, but there's Clontarf Beach. And it turns out if it rains for 48 hours, the nutrients go in, the little fish are all activated and, you know, keeps moving up the supply chain. And there's underneath Clontarf Beach, there's what's called the hole. There's an actual physiological feature that goes 200 metres down. And that's where the bull sharks live. That's the bull shark city. So at dawn, if it's a cloudy day at dawn and it's rained for 24 hours and it's Clontarf Beach at dawn, that's where you're most likely to get eaten by a shark. Yeah. And the last person who was a woman in the 1940s who did that. And I did it 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
All on my own.
Yeah.
It wasn't...
Do you enjoy the danger, the risk of it, or the...
I wanted to sense them. Yeah. Now that I'd sense them in other places, I want to see whether I could sense them louder. And you could. They were screaming. It was like rush hour traffic.
I like listening to you, Andrew, because it's like being in a bar somewhere in the world late at night with somebody telling you stories in
that
a lilting Irish accent that sometimes... Well, I've swum in Australia. I was off Bondi Beach. So if you're going to go there again, I lost a watch there, quite a valuable watch I've been given.
I'll get it for you.
If you could look out for it.
I'll get the sharks to find it for you.
Yeah.
It might pass through one of them, but you'll get it back.
Okay, I want one of those magical things to happen because it was. I had a dreadful admission I had to make to my parents. I'd lost the watch they'd give me for my 18th or whatever.
That happened to me, Clive.
Yeah?
On my 18th birthday, my parents, we didn't have a lot of money and they got me a watch.
Because watches were important years ago.
And I lost it on my 18th birthday on the town.
Oh, that's a bit bad. That's sooner than I did. But
I just cried all night. My parents were good about it, but it's still to this day, I feel.
I know.
Spasm of shame.
Okay. Oh well, we're bonding over lost watches on Bondi Beach.
And spasms of shame.
Spasms of shame. So your next wonder. This is a very interesting, a literary one. The Leopard.
Yes.
By Giuseppe Lampedusa.
That's right.
A fine book, a prize-winning book. Oh, but why have you chosen it as a wonder of the world? What is it about this particular
candor?
Candor. Yes. You have to expand on that.
Yes. No. Yeah. But what a virtue, though.
Yeah.
You know, and so rare. I mean, it is rare, candor.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, so the Leopard is the biggest selling book in the Italian language, sold over 4,500 copies. And the in Italian, you know what I mean? It's you know.
So it's published in 1959.
That's right. So Tomasi di Lampedusa, right, is the guy who wrote it, who was the Duke of Lampedusa, which is an obscure island that's now become famous because of the migrant crisis. It's actually closer to Libya than it is to Italy, but nevertheless, it's Italian sovereign territory. And he was the Duke of there, right? And he was from Sicily. And in the 50s, him and his wife, he was the Duke of Sicily and Lampedusa, and they were very famous for being the jet set. Everybody would come and stay at their castle. They hosted a lot of parties for movie directors and everything else. And he would always tell people he had a novel in him.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, ah, it's very good. Yeah. But everybody dismissed him as, being, you know, upper class but a bit lightweight and whatnot. A great guy for a party, but not a serious individual, right? Yeah. And he wrote this novel, which was set in the 1870s when the unification of Italy, right? Obviously, Giuseppe Garibaldi and the whole, you know, thing. And he said it, he's basically, it's, so he's in the 50s writing it.
Yeah.
And it's, the book is set in the 1870s. And it's
about his great-great-grandfather.
Also. That's right, who was also the Duke of Sicily, right? And that's, on the surface, the story, right? What happened in reality was he never got it published in his own lifetime. He got knocked back by everyone.
Yeah.
Despite his old social connections and media connections, everybody was like, yeah, no. When he died, his nephew, his nephew is Tancredi, who discovered this manuscript and read it. And in the book, the manuscript, Tancredi is also in it as the beloved nephew in the 1870s. And it's basically an autobiography fictionalized as his great-great-grandfather.
Yeah.
Nobody ever read it in his lifetime. And it is extraordinary piece of incredible emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
But the candor in it is incredible. And obviously, you've got the flavoring of this incredible seismic change in Italian society.
So whether these old aristocrats should carry on the way they had been living or embracing the new order.
Yeah, but it's also
the revolutionary.
Like,
Garibaldi was
that's
around,
right. Yeah. All that's the macro story. Yeah. But then it's the emotional story of his own emotional journey, his life, how he actually genuinely felt about his wife, his children, his beloved nephew, his mistress, his gardener.
Yeah.
It's shocking in its candor,
but
beautifully written. And it's such an amazing backstory as well.
And this old aristocrat in the story has to decide whether to marry off his nephew to the beautiful daughter of a corrupt, dodgy...
Yeah, a nouveau riche guy. Yeah. And that's all part of it as well. Yeah.
So when did you come across this this book?
I was driving in the car. I didn't attend university. I started doing stand-up when I was 17.
Yeah.
And my university course has been listening to Radio 4 in the car.
Yes.
And
you might have got a lot of wrong stuff from that as well, to be honest. But
some of those shipping reports were wrong.
Yeah. So you're self-taught? Did you read it in English or in Italian?
No, in English, But Italians, if you could speak English, you could read Italian and understand 90% of it.
Well, maybe. But
more than German, more than Germanic languages. It's weirdly intelligible. Okay. But I read it in English. And there was a thing on it about it years ago. Mm. And I was in driving, plowing up and down the M1 or whatnot. And I went, wow, what an amazing, interesting backstory. And then I read the book and I was like, this is what I like. This is emotional candor from another heterosexual man.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, no, oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
No,
and it's not like, I mean, I love Steinbeck and I love Hemingway, but it's always one remove.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? They're always talking about another subject.
Yes.
Tell me about you, fucker.
Yeah. Okay. So an excellent book. I must have, I haven't read it. I was once in Sicily with some friends and somebody that I didn't know particularly well. So, have you read The Leopard? And I said, well, no, I haven't. Well, you're here in Sicily. You should have read it before coming. And I thought, well, yeah, maybe I should. And I will read it now. I remember saying that. I will read it now. And we discussed it a lot. It discussed it a lot.
Yeah,
and I now realise the years have gone when I haven't read it now.
Yeah.
And if only I'd done so, I'd be able to engage.
It's a wonderful read as well. Like, I mean, it is great prose.
Yeah. All I know about is that the title in Italian doesn't mean leopard. It's a different animal. I can't remember the name of the animal. It's a small lynx-like animal.
Yeah.
And it's been translated as the leopard, so we always call it leopard.
I think it's a heraldic thing. It's the same with the three lions on an English jersey heraldically are actually leopards.
They are leopards. In this case, it's a different... it is the heraldic device in his coat of arms, but it's an animal, a sort of Saharan animal. But for some reason, it doesn't mean much in English, so it's always been called the leopard. Really? But it loses that relevance to the story.
And the connection to North Africa, of course.
I thought I'd written down the name of that animal, but turns out I haven't.
Maybe it's a civet. You know, it's the most expensive coffee in the world.
Yeah, I know. They
eat them.
It's not a civet. It begins with S. And I'm sorry I didn't write it down correctly. Anyway, so very interesting wonder.
There's Italian literature for you.
Yeah, excellent.
But you didn't think you were going to find yourself in this basement.
Oh, we've covered it. Well, not everyone's been here for this, but I've sat through lots of wonders of lots of different people. Nobody, that's not an overlap. Nobody else has chosen any Italian literature in the course of
Can I recommend one more Italian thing?
Yeah, if you want to.
Norman Lewis.
Oh, yes.
You remember, he was a British travel writer. Yes. He was really quite famous in the 70s. And he wrote these amazing books. But he served in the Second World War as British military intelligence in Naples.
Right.
For the whole of 1944. And he published in the 70s his diary entries as an intelligence officer in charge of Naples in 1944. It's just literally called Naples 44.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing.
You're straying into almost another wonder here. You're going to have eight wonders if I'm not careful. We'll have to put that as a sub-wonder of just Italian literature generally, or a literature about Italy.
The beguiling Italian South.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So your next one is Lebanon.
Yes.
The country Lebanon. Now, I know you know all about this because you had this as your specialist subject on Mastermind.
Oh, yes.
Celebrity Mastermind.
Yeah, I went for the Lebanon.
Yeah. And is this right? Because, again, you see notes about things. You didn't know anything about the Lebanon until you were booked to appear and you mugged up on it.
That's right.
Well, that's a mad subject to mug, because it's a very complicated history of the Lebanon. Even just learning which religious groups there are.
14 of them.
Yes, there's a lot, you know.
It's basically, if you can imagine Northern Ireland, only the size of Wales and 14 different type of fuckers hating each other.
Yes, yeah.
That's what has always captivated me about the Lebanon. I'm like, well, watch this, you two flag pricks in Belfast. How about 14 flags and a ski resort in the middle? Like, amazing.
And so you mugged up on that and did pretty well. Did you win the competition?
I did, I got 24 points.
Yeah.
24.
Well, and that's why it's a wonder to you. That.
No.
Have you been inspired to go to Lebanon?
No, Christ knows, it's a shithole. That was an absolute basket case. No, I am... the reason, genuinely, was the Irish Army have always provided troops for UNIFIL, which is the UN...
Yeah.
On the border between, you know, Israel and southern Lebanon. So Ireland's always had this weird connection to Lebanon.
All right. Yeah.
And then, you know, in the 80s, when it was all kicking off in the north of Ireland and in Lebanon at the same time.
Yeah.
The fact that there were 14 of them, I thought, like, that made me feel so much better.
Yeah.
About, so, you know.
It's
about
more complicated anyway. Yeah. And they have a very complicated constitution based on the proportions of the population.
In 47.
Yes.
Yeah, which is
and
totally
they don't dare do another census because the president has to be, I don't know, a Christian, let's say, and the prime minister has to be a Muslim.
That's right.
And the Druze get to be something else.
So, that's right. The president has to be a Maronite Christian specifically. Yeah, yeah. And all that carry on. So the reason why I chose it... Now, I'm going to let you in on the sneaky secrets if you're ever going to do the show.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. So, you're against the clock. Most people choose something that's close to their heart. So, they're football team or their favorite band or some, you know what I mean? Something that is almost part of their identity, like, you know, Liverpool and Hibs and, you know, football. So they choose something that's very close to their heart.
Yes.
Right? Now, the more specific you use your topic on Mastermind, the longer the sentence by its nature.
Yes.
Right? This example, there was a guy who chose, in the show I was on, chose Alex Ferguson.
Yeah.
So you end up, the question ends up being three sentences against the clock.
Yes.
Right? Whereas there's only so much you can gild the lily of what's the longest river in the Lebanon?
Yeah.
Latani.
Yeah.
But like, there's only so much you can do it. So I decided, instead of take my emotional register away from it and not have be connected to it.
Yeah.
Right? So because what happens is, you go, this is something that really matters to you. It's your identity. First question comes out, you fluff it, and all of a sudden you're having existential angst in a leather chair on television.
But I suppose if you already have a knowledge of stuff, you come to it thinking, well, I know half this already.
That's
I just
right.
have to top it up. Whereas if you start from a standing start...
Exactly.
You are... Challenging yourself.
Yeah, and also it's a fascinating subject.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so I basically what I did was I broke the country down into 10 topics and then set 10 questions on each topic. So I had 100 questions and 100 answers in my mind's eye.
Yes.
When I sat in the chair.
I've been to Lebanon. I actually made a documentary about Lebanon.
Really?
Not that I can recall all the facts to match yours, but it was a couple of things I think worth mentioning at this stage. So there was a book to go with it. So and I was writing the book at the same time as I was making the documentary.
Awesome.
And to explain the history of Lebanon and why there are so many things, it took me about 6 pages. And then when I came to do the voiceover part of the documentary, it was me arriving at the airport and I drive about, you know, 300 yards and meet my first interviewee.
Yeah.
And I said, well, where do I explain the history of Lebanon? Well, you do it there. You do it, it was a voicing over that car journey, which lasts about 30 seconds. And
impossible.
Well, that's the nature of these things. So it's why I think it's why people do book tie-ins of documentaries, because you have to kind of know the stuff and you want to put it down somewhere to demonstrate you know, because you can't get it into the TV program.
And you did Beirut?
Yeah, it was mostly Beirut. We were looking at places with a bad reputation. It was after the fighting, or most of the fighting had finished. Yeah. So I did a great trip to see Walid Jumblatt.
The warlord of the Druze.
Yeah, and we drove up into the hills. We got there, and do you remember him? He was a playboy for a while, and
That's
he took over from his father,
who got assassinated.
Yeah,
and
he became a very big figure. Yeah. And we got there, and he said, I didn't know you were coming. With a film crew. And he said, he must have known. Why don't you go and film? There's a wedding taking place down in the village.
Right.
Between a Druze and a Christian.
Oh,
just
wow.
to demonstrate that things
are
much
moving
happier.
On. Yeah, yeah.
So we went away and did that. Then we came back, and then a huge feast he'd got from somewhere. Maybe he does it every day, but for us, he provided. And we chatted away over lunch. He was most indiscreet and rude about the Americans, rude
Everybody,
about all the other
group.
And we said, we have to do the interview now. Oh, well, I normally have a sleep after lunch.
He's good. If you don't know him, he looks, he's bald, he's
hair,
big lugubrious eyes and his massive moustache.
Yes.
And he basically, the Druze are a fascinating people.
A weird group or tiny sect.
There's Druze in Lebanon, there's Druze in Israel, there's Druze in Syria.
Yeah.
Largely, that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, except for a diaspora.
Yeah.
But the Druze in Israel are a key part of the Israeli fighting force.
Yeah.
They fight with the Israelis. And the ones in Syria fight for Assad. And his lot, he switched them back and forward. Like, an incredible political operator.
And complicated beliefs. They don't really like explaining too much.
That's right. It's a syncretic religion. Yeah. They're not allowed to tell you. They don't marry out like traditionally like Jewish people. There's 1 million of them worldwide.
Yeah.
The most famous one is the voice of Casey Kasem. Who was the voice of Scooby-Doo?
No, George Clooney's wife is the most famous.
Oh, I guess she is now. You're right. Yes. Amal Clooney. Yeah, she's Druzy as well. But of a different vintage.
Yeah.
But he is. But Walid Jumblatt is one of the greatest political survivors. Like you said, is all his brothers, all his uncles, his dad and his granddad were all assassinated because they keep switching sides.
Yes.
Pro-Western, pro-East, you know. Yeah. Everybody, but an incredible, fascinating man.
Well, he was a very affable person, but we never could get him to say all the indiscreet stuff.
Absolutely,
once
no
the
chance.
Cameras rolled, he was A, half asleep, and B, very discreet. Rugby is your next to wonder.
Yeah.
So do you play it? You watch it? You've You used to play it?
Well, I played as a boy. I went to a rugby school. I'm 5'6". I was an excellent centre at 12 and 13. Yes. And by 14, everybody else's balls dropped.
Yes.
They became giants.
I know, I remember this. Yeah.
Just being smushed into the mud in November.
Yes.
And that's when I discovered the drama school. Well, yeah, but my love of both codes.
Yeah.
I've always loved Union because obviously that's Ireland.
Yeah.
And then during lockdown, I discovered League.
Yeah.
Love League now as well. Like,
all right.
Oh, yeah.
And you extend to all football, because football has an odd history, sort of the middle of the 19th century onwards. There's Australian rules football, American football, Union, Gaelic football. Yeah. They're all fairly similar, or they were, and they've gone down. It's like an evolutionary divide.
Right. Absolutely.
Do you like rugby union the most? Or the?
Well, I mean, it's what I know, being Irish, you know. I mean, it's pretty much, there is a tiny amount. I'm going to go see Ireland play Lebanon in the Rugby League World Cup in the autumn.
Oh, really?
They're playing...
Combining your wonders.
Yes, exactly,
That's very good.
They're going to be playing at Lee Centurion's ground.
All right.
So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yes.
But they'll thrash us because the Lebanese team are just dudes from suburban Sydney.
Yeah.
Who are, some of them are some of the top players in the league. So.
Yeah.
And I honestly have no idea who plays league for Ireland. But... But I love it.
I didn't know they played rugby league in Ireland at all.
The Wolfhounds, they're called. It's very, very small town.
Yeah.
But what I love about both codes, as we've discussed, I also love football. But what I love about both codes of rugby is there's no shirking.
Mm.
It's like being on the stage. There's no hiding place.
Yeah.
You know? You know what I mean? If you're out there on the pitch, boy or girl, either code, you're going to get smashed.
Well,
you're going to get smashed.
But rugby union has become more like that, hasn't it, over the years? They're all big guys now.
Much bigger.
Yeah. And then you thump into each other more than dodging around each other. It seems.
It depends who's the coach and what style you play. That's very much the Springboks game.
All right. Well, I only ever played at a school when I was, a bit like you, I was small and fast. I played on the wing three quarter. The ball comes down the line. And then somebody hits you, and you're spashed in the mud, or... Every now and then you skip round them and score a try, but not enough times to make me want to do it.
to do it again.
I was a bit sporty when I was young, but a bit like you, I drifted off to other things. But
that's what I love about it. I love the endeavour.
Yes.
I love the endeavour of rugby. It's impossible to not be doing it.
The one thing I find with, if I watch an odd international match, you think, you want your team to win, but half the time you have to wait for the referee to tell you what happened. And because nobody else knows.
Clive, I work for BT Sport Rugby.
Yeah.
And I haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of giant men on top of each other.
Yeah.
And there's a geography teacher peering into it all. And then he blows a whistle and goes, well, it's that side.
Somebody's hand went slightly over something. It's a penalty. You could score some extra points for nothing much happening in the middle of a game.
That's right. And as an actual professional rugby commentator, what I do is I wait till somebody says something first.
Yeah.
And then I go, yeah.
Yeah.
he's incredible soft hands. What a jackler. What a jackler. I tell you what the three-second ruck speed, that's Leinster's.
They're going to spot this eventually.
Nobody knows. Yeah. Nobody knows. There's a giant pile of men.
Yes.
Who knows what's going on in there?
Well, there can be all sorts of things going on with the giant pile.
I can tell you what's happening.
Yeah.
There's two cops feeling each other's ghoulies. That's what's happening.
That's part of your commentary on the game. Yeah. It was better in the old days when people had jobs. It wasn't professional. They just turned up a bit sort of worse for wear and then ran around a bit and somebody won. Now they're too...
And
all
the
sport is now ruined by
There's not
practicing.
Enough raking either. Nobody rakes each other anymore. For those of you who don't know, that's in rugby. Just get people with their studs.
Yeah.
Just slash them across the back.
There's a lot of things. Poking people's eyes out.
There was a lot of gouging back in the day. Yeah. You've got to admire a good gouge.
We've got to move on. Australian fauna is your next wonder.
Yes.
All Australian fauna, you'd like marsupials?
Well, it kind of jumps back to what we were talking at the top. The reason why I did I'm a Celebrity was to get amongst the fauna.
Yeah, but you were in a TV studio, essentially.
No, you're in the bush, dude.
You are, yeah.
You're in the bush. Like, they're there.
Yes.
So... The brown snake is a chasing snake.
Right.
It's a big snake.
That's not an expression you want to hear, a chasing snake. Yeah, yeah.
It'll chase you.
Yes.
And it's a good couple of metres long. When we went in there, one of the guys...
Yeah.
The Aussie Special Forces are in balaclavas the whole time.
Yeah.
And they're not allowed to talk to you.
Yeah.
And what happens, a bit that's never shown in the show.
Yeah.
I don't know why, because they show everything else, but...
Yeah.
So if you're in the camp,
yeah,
and you've been picked by the general public or whatnot, yeah, to go off to do the trial,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
Aunt Deck will come in and you, Andrew, are going off to do the Ark of Agony, right, and you're like, all right,
yeah, yeah,
and then they leave, right, they walk off set, cut,
yeah,
right, they off, and then two just giant dudes in balaclavas just go,
wow,
and they lead you off, and they hood you. You're hooded.
Yeah.
And then they bundle you into the back of a lorry and they trundle you around the mountainside.
Yeah.
And make you sit in an unair-conditioned lorry for half an hour while you can hear animals roar and scream. And then they pull you out, pull the bag off your head, and there's Aunt and Deck again.
Yeah.
Hello, Andrew.
Yeah.
Are you ready to do the trial?
Yeah. Yeah. So have they just driven you around in a circle and taken you back to the original?
It's incredible. It's a purpose-built set.
Yes.
The giant set. It's sort of like...
Yeah.
I guess if you take in the whole of Bristol Square and the whole of George Square, yeah, and it's sort of this sort, yeah, of... Actually, do you know what? It's more... It'd probably be like, map-wise, the size of the Meadows.
All right.
It's all up and down hills. And,
okay.
And after the British show ends, the Germans go in. They just one show after another.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. God, but the animals are wild in there. So
yeah,
there's one day, I'm coming back from the Dunny. There's, yeah, one just... It's a long festival long drop toilet.
Yes.
And you've got to kick it at night so that the huntsman spiders fall off it and don't land on your head while you're having a shit. The, okay, hunties the size of your hand.
I know, I've heard of them. But
they're completely harmless. They're like a British...
You don't have that happening when you're...
No,
you
know, no. But they're the size of your hand. But
yeah,
they're like a drained spider. They're like a British drained spider, only, yeah, fast.
Yes.
So you kick them off and you come out, and one night we were told, if you ever see a snake, what you have to do is put your fist in the air and shout, snake, snake.
Yes.
And then the SAS will show up and deal with it.
Yeah.
It's pretty reassuring.
Yeah.
So I'm coming back from the Dunny, yeah, one night, and there is a brown snake, big brownie, yeah, just blocked my path, which could outrun a man.
Yeah.
And has a giant head and can kill you and wants to kill you.
Yes.
Right? This isn't just
They've got it in for you.
Yeah, yeah. They want to do it.
Yes.
It's not like a Scottish guy at a wedding. He has a knife, but he doesn't mean any harm. Right? This is like...
Yeah.
He's... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He wants to.
Yes.
So I'm there, and I went, snake, snake. Nothing.
What about your fellow campmates?
They're all asleep. I was the last one up, so I'm like, snake, snake.
Yeah.
And two dudes amble in, and they must have been the territorial division of the Australian SAS. These pair of tubby maniacs, well, they waddled in with a potato sack, and, you know, in those little crook sticks. Or,
yeah.
They went, where is it? I went, it's just gone into this rockery. We slept around a rockery that was half real, half fake.
Right.
That the camera array was built into. But half of it was real. And the brownie had just gone into this little crevice right beside where I sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just gone in there. And they went, oh. And they peered in.
Yeah.
And they just went, he's fucked off. And they fucked off.
Yeah. Did you get a good night's sleep after that?
I can't say I did. And then there was also the funnel webs were there as well. But there was loads.
And they can kill you, can't they, funnel webs?
A funnel web will, yeah. I mean, like I said, we had the antidotes. But
I assumed you were talking about kangaroos and wallabies. And things that were trying to kill you.
Which I want to get to.
Oh, right.
Right.
We're running out of time.
Right,
so
but I need everybody to know, right? I took the kids to the zoo the other day.
Yeah.
They've got a koala. Everybody queues up to see the koala. Koalas are useless, smelly pricks.
Yeah.
They're useless.
Yeah.
They're nowhere near as... They stink.
Yes.
They're half dead. They've got poxy claws.
Yeah.
They, honestly, you're past one. You take a picture with it. Honestly, nothing loves you less. Right? Just...
Yeah.
Just skagged out of its mind.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful animal. Don't waste your time. The greatest Australian animal, and nobody knows outside of Australia, is the quokka.
The quokka.
Oh, my God. The cutest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Most life-affirming moment you can have with an animal is a quokka. It's like a tiny kangaroo.
Yeah.
Only much cuter. It permanently has a smile on its face, just the way its mouth goes. It's got massive eyes, and it skips towards you for a hug.
Yeah.
Because it only exists on this little island off Perth.
Yeah. And can anyone confirm these? They do.
You met a quokka, right?
Are you Australian?
Can you agree?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so lovely.
Because I always think I do need corroboration with any of your stories.
Well, of course.
I don't want to go, oh, quack, I was going to... And then...
I believe the term is trust but verify. But you've got to, the quacka. Every time people waste their lives with a kangaroo, I'm like, quackas.
Yes.
It'll see you and it'll come, it bounds over to you for a pet.
Oh, right.
They love to be cuddled and petted.
All right, I'm going to have to rush you on because we've already gone beyond time. We've got one more wonder to do,
which
is the mystery of the miniature coffins on Arthur's seat.
Does everybody know about these? You know about them.
I do, but it's the mystery side of it that attracts
Fascinating.
You.
Fascinating. So
they were discovered in
1830s.
Yes.
Some young lads, Fienbra, probably out the fucking arsehole of the tune.
Yeah.
They were hunting rabbits up on Arthur's seat. In the 1830s, and they found this piece of slate, and they pulled it out, and inside were all these miniature dolls in coffins. They're like the size of a hand, and there's only 9 left in existence, and they're all just around the corner in the museum.
Yeah,
the National Museum of Scotland has them. Each one of them is a little wooden skeleton with hand-stitched clothes, all individual, in these little wooden coffins. And to this day, nobody knows what they are or who made them or why. Fascinating.
Yeah, it is a mystery, and it's not. But they're not ancient. They worked out. I think it's 1836 they were found.
That's right.
And they were probably made in 1830.
That's right.
So they're recent to that time.
That's right. Some people think Edinburgh, because it's on the North Sea, had a connection to all the Hanseatic League port towns of the North Sea and the Baltic, and they think the German sailors had a tradition of keeping these little as memento, or, you know, sort of lucky
good luck charm.
Yeah, that's right.
Or it could be commemorating the victims of Burke and Hare.
That's right. It could have been.
Yeah,
they think it could have been to do with body snatching and Burke and Hare.
Yeah,
but they honestly don't know. And what? It's amazing about them, and they're worth seeing because they're very skillful. They think the tools that were used to make them were the same tools as a cobbler would use.
Mm.
But beyond that, they have no clue. They don't know whether it's... But it connects into this sort of... This is my 27th year at the Fringe. My dad's sort of family are actually from Edinburgh. My name, Andrew Maxwell, is the most... You know, if you need to make up a fictional Edinburgh man's name...
Yes, yeah.
You know what I mean? Andrew Maxwell.
So you're really Scottish, you think?
I'm more Edinburgh than Scottish.
That would be included in Scotland, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I know, but like...
Yeah, but specifically.
My ties are here,
yes,
right?
Yes, okay.
And there is something, you know, it's Edinburgh's like Florence. These are cities with great old money.
Yeah.
And then... An underclass that are almost never seen.
Yeah.
And those conditions make darkness.
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? There was my very first year at the Fringe, 1992. A woman was found in the drains underneath the grass market. Right. I was reading all the local news for new material.
Yeah.
And she was found, and she was presumed to be a sex worker or a prostitute, as they were called at the time. And she was in that day's news and never mentioned again.
Right.
It was the same year that the Edinburgh Council rounded up all the tramps, the old school beardy, shouting in doorway tramps of Edinburgh, told them they were going to be treated to a day out, put them into 3 coaches and drove them to Glasgow and abandoned them. genuinely true. Yeah. You can still... It's genuine.
Have they ever come back?
Who knows? Whether, you know what I mean? But that Edinburgh did that. And Edinburgh has that. Like it's the same reason why you've got Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Robert Louis Stevenson, the Har... There's so much sort of stuff that's just slightly behind the scenes in Edinburgh.
Oh, I think we should have brought a lighting effect down right there.
Look, check them out.
That is your last wonder, the mystery of the miniature coffins on Arthur's seat.
Check them out in the National Museum.
Made by cobbler's tools, and that's the last
bit
of cobblers that you've brought to us today. So thank you very much. I got to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of 7. The one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it on this podcast. Well, I feel I should be choosing the leopard. I could be choosing the Lebanon because of having been there, but I think that last one really caps it because we haven't had much time to go into it. But the mystery of the miniature coffins on Arthur's seat. Half this audience, I feel confident, are going to go to the museum and check them out now. You'll have boosted the museum's flow through of people, and you've got probably a fridge magnet with them on or something now to boost their profit. But anyway, thank you very much, Andrew Maxwell.
Thank you, Clive. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.